Okay, we are here today with one of my good friends and an amazing person. His name's Chris Wilkins. He's a social worker up in Utah, and we're excited to hear all of your thoughts today about mental health, Chris. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm glad to connect with you.
Yeah, anytime. So would you mind just really quick to start us off, give the listeners, the peakholeness community, a little background about who you are and how you became an expert in mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. I started, I think I took an abnormal psychology class in my undergraduate program and kind of fell in love with the mind and just thoughts and actions and how they interact with each other, and kind of that chicken or the egg dilemma or the question that we all have. And so I just was really fascinated with some of these, all maybe even some of the high profile cases throughout history where somebody just did something real, kind of funky or out of the norm. And it just kind of drew my curiosity. And so I changed my major, or I guess I declared my major as psychology and started to pursue that. And then I found myself working in an addiction treatment facility, and then made my way to graduate school and just kind of slowly but surely, I guess, advanced in this field. And so it went from kind of a coordinated or uncoordinated set of events where there was just an in somewhere. I just knew somebody who made a suggestion that I might do well in this field, or I might do well in this program or in this job, and things just kind of took off from there. And so I've got my master's degree is in social work, and I'm a few couple of semesters shy of finishing my doctorate in behavioral health, and
Congrats, that's
have
great.
just
I didn't know that.
thanks most of the time I've been in residential treatment for addiction and substance abuse or mental health. And then over the last about 3 years, I've been running a private practice where we see people on an outpatient basis for those things, and a lot of trauma work as well.
Wow. Well, thank you. Well, I mean, as mental health is such a huge topic these days, in your experience with addiction, with trauma, the inpatient stuff and the outpatient stuff, what do you feel are some of the biggest issues in mental health that we see today, some of the most pressing concerns?
Oh, I think that, and this has probably been around for quite some time, but just people's limited access to quality care. I think so often, at least historically, going to therapy or needing a psychiatrist or a psychologist or something was, there's a huge stigma around that. Like, what's wrong with you? Why do you need to talk to somebody? Just kind of grow up, pull your, what is it called? Pull your boots up, or pull yourself up by your bootstraps, right? And it's like, well, everybody has a bad day. You're no worse off than anyone else. And so I think there's a stigma. It's getting better. It's getting less. And I think people are more likely to access care now, but we still have a great amount of work to do, I think, in normalizing treating the mind and the heart and the soul like we do the body for some medical condition, a physical condition. And so I think that limited access to care and the stigma. And then there are financial constraints where many insurance policies have behavioral health benefits, but there might be a separate or a high deductible. And so people would say something to the effect of, yeah, I'd go talk to somebody, but it's just so expensive. I can't afford it. And that adds to that stress so often for people. And so I think if we understood the cost benefit to dealing with our mental health, and how being well, being healthy, being balanced actually improves our lives, I really think most people would be participating in this kind of stuff, at least at some point in their lives. Maybe not forever. And ho actually, hopefully not forever, but we would recognize the benefits and get ourselves taken care of.
Yeah, I love that. And I wanted to just ask about that stigma, because I think that that's been a really big issue and an important topic over the years. But do you feel in your experience that that stigma is kind of going away for people who do seek mental health treatment? Or is there still some lingering? Yeah, tell me your thoughts on that.
I do think it lingers. And I'll just share maybe a little bit of personal experience. I experienced some abuse when I was younger and kept that hidden for, I think, 8 or 10 years, I think, before I ever shared that with another person, because of those stigmas, not wanting to be viewed as weak, or how would you let somebody do this? How, like, what's wrong with you? Are you broken now? Are you messed up somehow? And in our media, back when I was growing up, at least, mental health diagnoses were used as insults. They were used by the mainstream. They were used in junior high to call somebody names, to bully people. And so that kind of reinforced that, that negative stigma that, like, well, I don't want to be, I'll say something like, I don't want to be a freak, or I don't want to be labeled as a psycho or as a crazy person or something like that. If I go see a psychologist or a therapist or a psychiatrist or something like that. And so we kind of have this image of what it looks like to go to therapy. Like, I lie down on the couch and I cross my fingers over my chest, and or look at the Rorschach, like the ink blot test. Like that stuff doesn't happen anymore. Or maybe I should say, very rarely does that kind of stuff happen. But I think we're understanding what therapy actually looks like, what mental health treatment actually looks like. And most of us, as we recognize that, go, oh, that actually would be pretty nice. I'd be okay with that. But it definitely takes a little bit of exposure. Like, we got to dip our toes into the water a little bit before we start to feel a little bit more comfortable with what that process looks like. So I do think that there are little pockets of like communities where they talk more about getting help from somebody, and traditionally, like, men needing to have to go talk to somebody, it was like off limits. You just don't do that. That's not what men do. So actually, a good amount of my work is trying to destigmatize specifically for men, and in particular grief and loss work, where in the experience of reproductive loss, so much of that energy is focused on the mother, and rightfully so. I'm not trying to take away from that. Mm-hmm. But where a male figure or a father figure has lost, like, their path for healing may be different, but they I still believe they need support and they need care. So trying to destigmatize that, and also destigmatize that if I went to therapy before, it doesn't mean I am good forever. It doesn't necessarily mean that I'm healed and cured. trying to use the word, the words in remission, that if it's a mental health diagnosis or addiction or grief and loss or something to that effect, I can put that issue in remission, but it might come back at some point in time. Mm-hmm. So I might need to seek care at some point in the future, and that's okay. It doesn't mean I failed. It doesn't mean I'm not good at it, at getting better. It doesn't mean that I'm broken or like unsalvageable or something like that. And it also doesn't mean that the person I went to for help is terrible at it either,
Right.
It just is a matter of, this is life. And we are on a pretty intense roller coaster.
Man, I love that. And that, I just feel like there's so many thoughts from that, so much good information in what you just said. One question that came up, I guess I have a couple questions that came up, but here's the first one. Something that we see a lot, I think, in our experience with physical injuries, and something we talk a lot about in our program, for example, if someone sprains their ankle and they don't get that treated, they'll learn to walk in such a way that doesn't hurt their ankle, but over time it'll start to hurt their knee. And then if they don't get that treated, eventually they'll have hip problems, you know, just because their body's compensating or trying to avoid that pain. Do you feel with mental health that something similar can happen to those who, you know, like how you mentioned, you know, and I'm so sorry to hear that, but early on where you felt you couldn't get help and that people kind of bury that, does that over time lead to bigger and other issues in their lives?
Yes, absolutely. And I will say that without hesitation. I experienced it myself, and much of my work now is helping people to recognize, you know, there's a huge difference in my mind and in my experience between a coping skill and a coping mechanism. The coping mechanism is just like you were talking about with the ankle. Now I've got to compensate in some way where it's funny that you said that, you give me the chills, because I have ankle issues. I've sprained my ankles over and over and over again throughout my life.
Yeah.
And luckily it's been several years now since I've had a bad sprain. But we compensate, we start walking a different way that isn't going to hurt. Mm-hmm. And the body starts to get used to that. It starts to compensate in that way, but then it puts strain on the knees and the hips and the other ankles or the other leg or something like that.
Yeah.
And so it makes us more susceptible to injury down the road. And I've used the analogy of like a broken bone, mm-hmm. that if it heals properly, eventually it's going to be stronger. New bone grows. But if it doesn't heal right, they might have to go in and re-break it so that they can set it in place in the proper way so that that growth can take place and fix whatever that wound was. And so, in fact, we're experiencing that right now with my oldest, who mm-hmm. fractured her ankle. And, you know, we didn't think, it was one of those things that's like, it's just a bad sprain. It's going to be just fine. We misdiagnosed it. I misdiagnosed it as the dad, right? And I'm like, it's probably going to be fine. We need to do the rice stuff. We need to just take it easy. And then finally, I think it was 2 weeks later, I was like, okay, let's go get an x-ray. And sure enough, she's got a fracture. So that whole process, we get reminded that it's okay to go in and get the help and get the x-rays and get the assessments, get the diagnosis. And just make sure, like, is there something here? And I'm talking about like that parallel with our mental health or mental illness issues.
Yeah.
Like, maybe there's not depression or anxiety. Maybe it's situational. Maybe it's, there's a diagnosis called adjustment disorder, which feels a little bit softer or a little bit more, acceptable than like the scary words like depression, anxiety, panic. PTSD, those kinds of things. And so we don't need to fear a diagnosis. I would much rather, and I'll say this as the professional and as a patient, I would much rather know what's going on so that I can treat it properly than guess. And because so often we just aren't sure, just like with my daughter, thinking it's a sprain, or she's rolled it, she's turned it real bad, and we just need to relax it a little bit. Like, if there's structural damage, we got to go in and do the right things and get it taken care of.
Right.
And so I love that you brought up that analogy. I think that we compensate in a variety of ways. So if a young person is mistreated, they might start looking for acceptance in other areas to make up for that pain. They might seek acceptance in areas of life or from groups, say in junior high or high school, that might not necessarily be within their value system, might not actually be healthy for them or productive for them. But that group, say it's a gang, that group gives them something that they were missing. Maybe it's belonging, acceptance, feeling protected, where that issue from before is no longer a threat, because now there's this community that they might have or feel that they're a part of that neutralizes that original threat. Now, what that does is just like the knee or the hip compensating and developing pain or problems down the road, those decisions that we start making might further complicate the original pain, the original mm-hmm. struggle, mental health issues. And so just like physical illness playing dominoes, our mental health can domino and spiral out of control as well.
I love that. And just a follow-up question to that, example you gave with a person who, you know, is hurt in some way and seeks that acceptance in other areas. Is that kind of compensation reserved for someone, and when you say hurt, who experiences severe trauma, or can it happen to any degree? You know, if they're bullied or even just teased one day at school, can those things all lead to different levels of, I guess, side effects?
All of it, yes. So often we think of the most horrific tragedies as, man, that person has it the worst, and I'm so glad I didn't have to go through that. As long as I don't have to go through those things, I'll be just fine. Right. And even as I say that, I feel that emotion as a father, where it's like, there are certain things that I couldn't get through, certain tragedies and devastations that I just couldn't get through. Now, there might be somebody on the other end of the world that goes, yeah, but that's normal for us. That's typical for us. So we deal with that. Yeah, it sucks. It's terrible. It's horrific. But maybe we're used to it, kind of a thing. Like, we know it's a risk. And they might view things that we go through that we think are easier. And they might go, oh, I couldn't get through that. I don't know how you do it. And so it just is different, right? We all are wired differently. And so our experience is our own. And I think there's a term that I've used for a while called the trauma Olympics, where we might try to one up somebody else with our pain versus theirs. And I truly believe all we're trying to do is connect with them. If somebody says, hey, this just happened and it's terrible, our response where we say, yes, that's happened to me too, I think it's trying to validate them and go, you're not alone. Like, yes, me too. Like, you're in good company. But what we might tend to do is like one up them or hijack that conversation. And so maybe it suggested people that we're not really listening to their experience. We're just trying to tell them about ours. Now, the other part is when I observe somebody's pain, their struggle, their mental health issue, that we can't compare and contrast, because everyone's experience is unique. And so we need to be careful with doing that. We want them to feel like they're not alone, and they're not the first one. They're definitely not the last one is going to experience this. But the way we would treat that is not going to be just a cookie cutter method that's been applied to everybody. It's going to be specific to them. And so maybe to clarify that, that piece about our coping skills versus our coping mechanisms, and bring it back to that. Mm-hmm. If something painful has happened and I start doing this other behavior to escape, to numb out, say it's alcohol or drug use or some behavioral issue, once that chemical is taken away, that ability for me to numb out, I'm exposed to that, or I'm re-exposed to that original pain or that original trauma. Mm-hmm. And so I have to have that opportunity to work through those things. And so often we look at, like in the mental health field, we look at, well, let's treat the addiction. Well, this person keeps taking pills, or they keep drinking alcohol, or they keep smoking, or whatever else it is. That's the problem. No, it's not. For that person, now, that's the problem to the outside world. That's our observation of that individual.
Yeah.
But to that person, the pills, the alcohol, the gambling, the whatever it is, that's their solution. In their mind, they have come to believe that that's the thing they need to survive. They have come to believe that that's the thing they need so that they don't have to continually be exposed to that original pain, that original wound, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's a trauma or a loss or something along those lines. And so when we start to take away that chemical from them, or take away that crutch, that coping mechanism, it actually looks like they're getting worse. It looks like they're feeling worse. And so at the very beginning, we'll even use that phrase, it gets worse before it gets better. And it's not true, but it just feels that way. And it might look that way. But we have to get to the original wound so that we can actually clean that up and take care of that and set that, again, those physical analogies, you know, set the bone in place, or set the ligaments in place so that they can immobilize them even, so that they can heal. We do that with the mind and heart. And the way that looks, especially in addiction treatment, is reducing stress, trying to keep the stress level at bay so that the mind and heart can start to heal without sending the person over the edge with their mm-hmm. stress level. Because when somebody who deals with addiction gets overly stressed out, again, the mind believes that in order to survive whatever that stressor is, they've got to use, they've got to get high, or they've got to get drunk again. Mm-hmm. And so we have to keep that stress level low enough that they can actually heal.
Man, I love that. This is such great information. I have all these questions. Hopefully we can get to them all. But along those lines, back when you were discussing how we compare our traumas with each other, and that sometimes it can appear disingenuous if we, you know, let other people know we've experienced what they're experiencing. Do you feel that people or individuals, say, for example, when they go through that, for example, I remember when my wife and I, one of the pregnancies she had, she miscarried. And like you said, it was really emotional, but after it happened, we started hearing from everybody how they had miscarried, you know, multiple times or all these different times. And it kind of started to feel like we were ungrateful, or like we shouldn't need help because we don't deserve it yet. Like we haven't suffered enough to deserve help yet. Do you feel like that type of feeling is common with people who have suffered, but not, they might say not enough?
I think we minimize our own loss sometimes, unfortunately. And I'm sorry that you guys experienced that. That's so heartbreaking and so tragic.
Thank you.
I think let me chime in on another note. We all have different, or there are differing beliefs around an afterlife, differing mm-hmm. spiritual belief systems around what it's like to lose a child. And I think a lot of comfort can come for those who have a belief in an afterlife and what that might mean for reuniting with a lost loved one somewhere down the road. It breaks my heart for those who do not have a belief system around that, the devastation of feeling like I'll never see them again, or I'll never get to raise them. And it doesn't mean that we need to force our own beliefs on someone else in a pseudo effort to help them heal. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a very personalized opportunity for healing if we have a spiritual practice, or if we have a belief in an afterlife. Now, one thing that I think is very helpful for people who spend time with or are loved ones of those who suffer, who have suffered, a grief or a loss like that. Now, I might approach that situation like this. If we were outside talking and you shared with me that this happened, my response would be very much, I'm so sorry. That's like, what can I do? How can I support you? I'm here. I've been there. You're not alone. But then I'm going to bring it back to you. Tell me more, right? Because I want you to share with me. I want to be safe for you. But there's that also that part of my heart that goes ding, ding, ding. Like, here's my opportunity to connect with somebody too. Because when I had that loss, I felt alone. I felt unable to connect with anybody else. And so it's truly a sign, in my opinion, it's truly a sign that we have unhealed wounds. If you come to me and say, this just happened, and I go, me too, let me tell you all about mine. And I completely forget what you've just shared with me. I don't believe for one second that people are doing it intentionally or selfishly or like consciously, that I don't want you to have that platform to be able to share your story. It's literally that wound inside of me going, I can't hold this in anymore. Mm-hmm. I've got to let this out, you know? And so again, it's our desire to connect with somebody who truly gets it.
And I'm really, really glad you said that.
And we're human. We're human. Yeah. We just don't know how to, like hear somebody's story and be a safe space for them, yeah, while simultaneously like observing transformations as we heal. And so it's, talking about it is good.
Yeah.
Regardless. I think that we less and less are doing the trauma Olympics where we're trying to hijack and compare and contrast. I think as we talk more and more about loss and we normalize addressing our suffering and healing through it, because we don't need to carry that weight around anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't need to carry the pain. And me healing from it also sometimes feels like a betrayal. So let me paint a picture. If I suffer a loss and I hurt from it, there might be a part of me that goes, well, if I'm not hurting from this anymore, if I'm not grieving anymore, is that a betrayal of the person I lost? Is that betraying their honor?
Yeah.
Or is that minimizing their memory or something like that? And I think I can understand that. I can comprehend that mindset while simultaneously considering that my loved one or my loved ones whom I've lost, my belief is that they're somewhere going, it's time for you to move forward.
Yeah.
Not move on. Doesn't mean move on and forget or something like that, but move forward.
Yeah.
Through this, you know, because there are survivors here that need you. They need you at your best.
Yeah.
You know, they're depending on you. And so it doesn't have to be all or nothing either. It doesn't have to be, well, this horrible thing just happened. I'm going to be in bed for the next 10 years and I'm not going to be able to, you know, get out. That's not realistic. Now, that is some people's story,
yeah,
mind you. The other side of that, the other end of that spectrum being, you know, at the funeral service, like numbing out and pretending like it never existed, like it never occurred and never happened. There's somewhere in the middle for each of us.
Mm-hmm.
And grieving is not a cookie cutter either. And so to be able to connect with someone else who's had a similar or very similar experience, I think is so beneficial for us.
Yeah, I love that. No, thank you for sharing all that and for the thoughts and things. Something I feel very strongly about as you're saying that is that health, overall health in a person's life is not an end in and of itself, but a means to an end. And health is a means to, like you said, be in a position to help people when they need it. Because I think, like you mentioned, it takes someone who has healed to help heal another person or a friend or a colleague or a family member. And so I appreciate you bringing that up and just putting words to all that.
Oh, of course.
So with the mental illness that you've seen and the people that you've worked with, I know that there are countless number of names to illnesses and things people can experience. But can I ask if you feel like there's a root cause for some of the mental illness that presents itself in people's lives, whether it be trauma or pain or fear or something like that? Or does everyone kind of have their own unique situation? And what are your thoughts on that?
We might set out to try to figure out all of those root causes, but it would take us a long time. But I'm thinking of, I'll just list the ones that come to mind, like trauma, a loss, a lack of connection or being wanted or accepted, even from infancy, you know, feeling like we just never connected or we weren't nurtured on some level. I mean, we also have the organic biological mental health issues, you know, chemical, like when our chemistry is off, and somebody is diagnosed with something, then you have the situational things where personality disorders might be developed. You know, somebody witnesses something gruesome or horrific. Somebody is assaulted, abused, neglected on some level, and we develop like skewed attachments where we might not trust other people. And then again, that snowball effect or domino effect takes place where, you know, fool me once, how's that phrase go? Shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. Where if I experience something where someone hurt me, I might be less inclined to trust others ever again.
Yeah.
And so I might hold myself back from connecting with healthy others because I'm afraid that that same thing is going to happen all over again.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing is broken homes and families, where maybe somebody's born into a situation where both parents are using substances or involved in criminal activity or violence or domestic violence. And so our people, our kids can be exposed to a lot of different things that lead them down a path of thinking these really unsafe and unhealthy things are normal and mm-hmm. natural. None of us at very, very young ages are able to comprehend that our heroes could do something wrong.
Yeah.
That's a learned experience. That comes in time. And I don't know the exact developmental age or stage where it clicks that our parents aren't perfect or that are the superheroes that we grow up loving might have flaws, or they might have a backstory that led them, like of trauma
yeah.
and tragedy that led them to becoming a superhero, right? All of the fairy tale princesses, you know, there was some trial, there was some tribulation, there was some chaos, you know, that almost perished before they were able to be successful, you know, and become happily ever after and those kinds of things. And so, of course, there are those circumstances. And then we also have a ton of media out there that we have access to that is increasingly violent and vulgar and sexualized that we as a society, I think, have become desensitized. As I think about some of the tragedies that happen in our world, where people are bullied or people are mentally ill and unstable and they find access to a weapon, or they find access to some method to hurt other people. It absolutely breaks my heart. I cannot help but believe that we have a mental health component to all of those things. We had a little visitor step into the room there for a second. So
no problem.
Sorry about that. the kiddos and some cousins are out there playing. So anyway.
No problem.
I cannot help but recognize that there's a mental health component to these situations, to these tragedies, where oftentimes somebody snaps. Their needs might not have been met. They're not being nurtured properly. And then the other side to that is our values. Many of the people that I work with come in, and they aren't committing horrible crimes. They might just feel lost. But one of the common things that they say is, I don't, like, my values are messed up. And I hear that phrase so often and I get curious, like, what do they mean when they say this? And we start to explore what their values are. And for some people, it's as simple as recognizing that, like, they just kind of did whatever their parents told them to do. And then they became adults and it was like, well, now what? Nobody's
there.
It's like giving me the blueprint. And so we have to maybe start from scratch and identify what their values are and then help mm-hmm. them to live those values. Because if they can live their values congruently with what they identify them as, then most of the time people are fairly happy, feel fairly yeah. successful. Often it's when we have a list of identified values and we live outside of them, we live incongruently with them, that we just can't really reconcile the difference. And so something has to change. Something has to come up that we either realign with those values or we change them. And
yeah.
it's very common for young adults to go into adulthood and say, okay, like, I'm moving out, or I'm on my own now. I'm kind of free from the thumb or
yeah.
the, you know, big brother or whatever.
And yeah.
and it's like, okay, this is a very important moment because we're determining, or this person's going to determine what their values are going to be.
Yeah.
But some folks explore a little bit, maybe get themselves, have some fun, but maybe get themselves into a little bit of trouble too. And if we can help them navigate to what their core values are going to be, then I think we can prevent, do a lot in the way of prevention from furthering problems, pains, traumas, and even where they might hurt somebody else.
Yeah.
And that is a very wide range of things. Obviously we've had some some unfortunate, many unfortunate circumstances where people are hurting others in our society. But that might also include just being mean to people, being in relationships and then not being loyal or not communicating. Like the amount of hurt that we can cause to another human is a very wide spectrum.
Yeah.
So I think our mental health issues come from somewhere, but we have to really get to know the person, their circumstances, and what they're going through before we can understand what we can really put our finger on, like what it is for them.
Yeah,
and quite often it's a multitude of things. And there might be a biological or genetic component, and then there might be that environmental stressor or those environmental stressors that really caused something to get worse, to really be exacerbated. So,
mm-hmm. No, I love that. Yeah, thank you. So this next question, I'm really excited to get your thoughts on. And we talked a little bit before about this, but just the question of healing and a person's ability to make all of this better that we've been talking about. So I guess the first part of the question is it possible for a person to heal from a mental illness, whether it's born from trauma, from experiences, wherever it comes from, is it possible to heal? And if so, what has to happen for that healing to take place?
I very much believe in grace, in healing, and in recovery. I do think that there are a few rare exceptions to that, where somebody has, maybe there's a diagnosis of like sociopath or psychopath, mm-hmm. Type where there's no empathy, and in general society, or even psychologists and psychiatrists would consider that this person is, I really hate this phrase, but too far gone, where they've maybe crossed over into a realm that there's a little or no likelihood of rehabilitation.
Yeah.
Now that's the rare exception. We hear those things in movies. We hear them on maybe it's in the tabloids or maybe it's on the news or whatever, but the horror stories. Now that exists, but it's so rare. Mm-hmm. It's much rarer than we think, than we fear. So often the things that we see on television about prison and jail, it's not what really happens there. But that doesn't sell as many tickets. That doesn't sell as many clicks.
That's right. So
the media tends to soup things up a little bit or hype things up a little bit. And maybe that's actually a good thing, that it's not as bad as they have portrayed, that we've perceived over the years. Now, one that I've shared with my clients for years is I don't treat hopeless causes. If I'm going to put in this effort, my hope is that the person sitting across from me is willing to do work as well. There's a big difference between can this be treated, can this be healed, and will I do the work for healing? And really, I think we'd have much better success rates if we could just guarantee that everybody would do their best, would work their hardest. You know, most people, at least that I've encountered, would be well, would be healthy. The work is so hard because it requires us to examine ourselves. It requires us to take a step back and maybe even be honest, maybe even be vulnerable and transparent that, you know, whether we want to call them our wrongs, our faults, our sins, our weaknesses, we've got to put them on the table. You know, we're exposing ourselves to some other human being who, mm-hmm. even though they say they're a therapist and they have this degree or this license or whatever, this confidentiality agreement, what do they really think of me?
Right.
And so I've actually had some folks who have come into the office, and you can maybe it's an assumption, but it feels like they're kind of gauging the shock for shock value. Mm-hmm. As they start to share things with me, maybe get me to breathe more deeply or to have a shocked look on my face or something like that. And my typical response is, you know, my practice is in Utah County, Utah, kind of a, not to compare and contrast, but less intense than the work I did early in my career, where I worked for federal pretrial and probation and the Bureau of Prisons on the west side of Phoenix, where I worked with some human trafficking and drug trafficking type scenarios, and were with some individuals who hurt children. You know, those were some of the things that might have gotten a shocked look on my face, or something where I'd maybe a pit in my stomach. But even still, I believe in healing. And so even individuals who come into my office and they've done things that they're embarrassed of, they're ashamed of, or there's a diagnosis that's causes them to be embarrassed or feel like they aren't themselves. Mm-hmm. This is a human. These are humans. And what's the difference between us? There's not much difference, if any.
Right.
And so if we can observe these situations, or if we can connect with individuals and help them along this path, I think there's a great opportunity for healing and for growth. One of the other things, or maybe a follow-up answer to that is, as therapists, we're taught the most important thing for us to do is to validate the client. And so when we take our licensing exam, we're even given all these multiple choice answers. And maybe there's a scenario where there's like an emergency situation, and it asks you, what's the first thing that you should do in this emergency situation? And it's an emergency where you need to call 911, where you need to administer CPR to somebody, like for life-saving techniques.
Yeah.
And one of the questions on there, one of the answers, the multiple choice answers, is validate the client. And that's the correct answer.
Interesting.
And, and that human, it's like the the protector. It's like, I don't need to validate anybody. I need to apply pressure here. I need to stop the bleeding. Yeah. I need to, you know what I mean? Like, I need to do CPR. So why, like, nobody needs to be validated, but the reality is we do.
Yeah.
Because if we're unvalidated in a situation like that, there might be a higher likelihood for somebody to go into shock. But if we can keep them connected, if we can keep like a eye contact, if we can help them stay present, we might actually prevent them from going into shock while emergency personnel show up.
Yeah.
One of the other things is when somebody comes in, and maybe it's not necessarily a first aid type emergency, but there's a scenario happening where if they don't feel the compassion and empathy and everything that is there, they might not be willing to continue opening up. So mm-hmm. often people will try therapy maybe for the first time, and they don't like how that goes. They don't feel accepted, or they might feel judged, and will throw a wall up, and they'll close themselves off to that type of healing relationship for the future. And so they might keep a secret. They might shy away from getting that help. So go back to maybe that original question. There are many, many people who are very successful in our society with mental illnesses that we can consider serious mental illnesses. Mm-hmm. But because they're in treatment, or they participated in treatment, and or are on medication, or are pursuing, or excuse me, are utilizing a plan for their well-being, they can be extremely successful, sometimes functioning even better than maybe the average person in society. And you would never know that they have a mental illness because they follow that routine. We all need routines, from those with a serious mental illness to just your average person, you know, or even the person who's, man, they seem to be at peak physical fitness or peak physical health. Like, you know, they get the exact number of hours of sleep every night. Like, their diet is perfect there. They have the exact amount of exercise that they need and sunlight and all those things. Mm-hmm. But they might be suffering in some other way. And so there is hope. I treat a lot of personality disorders. And one thing that I share with my folks is, if there's something here, if there's a diagnosis, we can treat it. And I would much rather that we be informed about what we're treating than guess or pretend and try to sweep it under the rug. So
yeah,
there's a lot of opportunity for people to be quote unquote just fine and functional if they can get the support that they need.
Yeah.
They've got to have qualified. And this isn't a knock on other health professionals that might not have gone to school or something like that. Some folks out there who are more the snake oil salesman, and we need to be very mindful of that, that we go to somebody who is intuitive, who has the appropriate training and the appropriate ability to help. So
I love that. Thank you. That's a great answer and great thoughts. This last question, and I appreciate your time today. I know we're a little over, but thank you for doing this. We, at Peak Wholeness, the goal is to help individuals reach peak physical, mental, spiritual, economic health. And I just want to know, from your perspective, what does it look like for you when an individual reaches peak mental health? And what does it look like for you for a person to obtain this peak wholeness?
I think it goes back to that original, our original values, whatever those are, and then following through with them. And that might mean every 6 months I've got to reevaluate my values. Maybe I let go of one of them and adopt a new value. And when we talk about values, it might be honesty, integrity, hard work, you know, service to others. Mm-hmm. It might be something a little bit more intense, a little bit more specific. It might be something a little bit less, you know, just be a good person.
Yeah.
We might have to change those every once in a while. Living according to our values, our physical, putting the right things into our body, our minds acute, keeping our minds alert. And I'm one who loves watching, but I, with both of those things, I read a bunch.
Sorry, say that one more time. Thing. You cut out
and
just
and it's really hard. So I love sports, shows, and I don't think either one of those are necessarily doing any harm to me, but too much of them can be problematic for a couple of reasons, because I mean, too much exposure to electronics and screen time and becoming a zombie in that way. But then the other part of what is it getting in the way of that might be a higher value for me? You know, I really love and appreciate being a father. And that time with my kids is so important to me. And if there's a game on, I might be totally aloof about what's happening in my kids' lives. And so one way to maybe meet in the middle with that too is there a common interest? Does one of my kids enjoy watching sports, or do they enjoy playing sports? And can I go participate in that with them? So I'm kind of getting that itch scratched of what I feel like my need is, but then also with my young person. You know, I get to spend that time with them and interacting with them and creating and forming and developing that bond.
Yeah.
Another thing is, so often is we're a little sleep in our society, and we justify it. We go through, I don't know, 500,000 of caffeine every day going, oh, it's all I can do. You know, I've got my business. We do have time for sleep. Response to that answer is being patient with ourselves and acknowledging that we are human and that we are not perfect. We are not expected to be perfect, and we must have grace for ourselves. And that doesn't mean we mail it in every day and we say, well, oops, I'm a human, so I made a mistake and I'll do it again in 2 minutes. How can I experience? How can I do get better and do better? But I'm going to trip up. I'm going to being humble to take feedback from other people, to hear when somebody might have concern for us. I love when I witness others saying, hey, I'm struggling with this, but this is what I'm doing about it. This is how I'm going about being better, doing better with it. That part of the journey is just so miraculous to me. So I think living that peak wholeness has to do with some combination, and that combination is going to be different for everybody. I think just like a dietary allergy that somebody might have, mm-hmm. we also have some allergies in another way to social gatherings. Some people thrive there. Some people can't stand being around too many people, right?
Yeah.
It's not a knock on them. It's nothing wrong with them. It's just what their preference is. It's just where they thrive. We need to normalize people being abnormal. And abnormal doesn't have to be weird. It doesn't have to be unhealthy. It doesn't have to be an off-putting word. But just being individual, being original, taking care of ourselves, not settling. And I think so often if somebody's going to the gym, you know, in a standard routine for 3 or 4 weeks, after that period of time, you plateau. You've got to adjust things. The body develops that muscle memory. You've got to adapt to help it to continue to grow stronger. And our minds and our hearts are the same. So the stressors that I'm capable of handling today, I would like to think that I can handle more today than I could 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Maybe there are people in my life who would disagree with that. If through today, if I have the perspective that through today is preparing me for what is yet to come, and this isn't a discouraging or pessimistic outlook, but it's preparing me for what is yet to come, that means I can handle more. I'm expanding my capacity. Not only am I expanding my capacity to handle stressors and the day-to-day operations of this life, of parenting, of being in a relationship, of having coworkers and those kinds of things, but it also expands my capacity to love others and to share my compassion with them. And we need so much more of that. I think the component that we might not consider enough about health is our ability to connect with other people. Yeah. I think we need those connections. I don't think men and women were designed to be hermits or to be alone. We need to 24/7 be around somebody else, but to be able to connect and to socialize and to share our compassion and to receive compassion from others. I think those things too.
I love that. Well, thank you so much, Chris. It's been so nice talking to you about all this and getting your thoughts. I really hope, as you listeners, I hope this has been inspirational and helpful. One plug, I guess, just right here at the end, Chris is in the process of founding a company called Heal the Hurt, and it's a nonprofit to help individuals get this mental health care where it may be difficult to afford it or things like that. So if anyone listening needs help or would like some professional assistance in their mental health and are unable to afford it, check that out, and maybe you'll get to talk to Chris. Anyway, thank you again, Chris, for your time today. We'll let you go, and we just look forward to all the good things you're doing.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time today. It's really good to connect with you.
You too.